It's Jay back in for another one, and today I have with me
Rosalito.
Captain Keith.
How's it going, fellas?
I'm good, I can't complain.
Right on.
Good, good. I'm glad to meet with you guys again to chat about another movie.
Yeah, man, it's been a long time coming. It's funny, remember when we saw the first one and we discussed the first one, and it was all crazy because it's almost as if we didn't know for sure if we were going to get a part two. And I haven't in a long time seen a movie that definitely felt like it wasn't complete, even though it was, but it wasn't quite complete, and no discussion, no talk of a part two. That's the first time I ever kind of heard that, especially with something this big of scale, like just being kind of cut short and not saying anything. Like Into the Spider-Verse, like the whole Miles Morales Spider-Verse thing, like that could have been just one, but it left with a little, like, you know, but we already kind of knew it was gonna be a part two, and then even the part two is split into, you know, two and three. So I was thinking, like, this is a big feat to make and very epic and definitely not the end. So how could it possibly end on this? And like I said, and for it not to be confirmed, and, you know, months after we're still saying, hey, have you heard anything yet about part two being made? Like, oh, it hasn't been, they're still deciding, like still deciding. Like in the past, you could even make a movie like this without shooting all three parts. And all you would be doing would just be cutting it up later on and adding special effects and whatever and doing some catch-up shots. But for the most part, all three episodes would have been shot. And it's just like he wasn't playing around for it to be a simple thing where, well, it was good enough. Like, that would have been so half-baked where if it was a point where you wasn't for sure if you're going to put out part two, you shouldn't have put out part one. So yeah. I thought it was very interesting how that was played, and I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. It was interesting.
I wonder if they did that because I don't know if it's part of it is that they weren't sure, like, what the reaction, how big of a movie the first one was going to be, as one reason why they kind of, like, kept it on the down low in terms of having a second one. They kept it. It was very ambiguous. You couldn't tell, like, what you knew, you had a feeling they would, but then it's like, are they, like, they it was the most under talked about thing, like, after the first movie, you know. So maybe that's part of it, but then maybe it's also, like, I don't know if that's a new tactic also, where they try to keep to make things, to keep people kind of confused and not sure. To I don't know if that makes sense in terms of, like, making it more, like, kind of, like, where it becomes more of a cult, like, whispered. Like, it's not, it's a rumor, so it raises up, like, more interest because you don't know that they're going to have a second movie. So you become, you know, anxious as a fan, and then when they do finally release the trailers for a second movie, then it magnifies because you didn't know up to that point if there was going to be a second one.
Well, I think that could be a dangerous tactic because the people who don't know for sure and they're hearing, like, you know, hearing people talk about it and saying, hey, it's not really complete and it's not for sure a part two, people may not invest in it. People might be like, oh, it's true. Incomplete. And the people who was halfway trying to see if they wanted to follow it, it's like, I'm not going to get into this.
Yeah, it's dangerous, especially because it's unlike, like, if it's a popular series like Star Wars, they could get away with that because Star Wars is so popular that they could, like, they're just, people are just, Star Wars fans are just so hungry for anything that they'll just still lap it up. But then Dune is, like, such a, even in its heyday with the Lynch, like, it doesn't really fall into, like, a mass popular type of movie. It's kind of was seen as a weird, quirky movie. This one is kind of the same, where it doesn't have, I think, a big enough initial big enough audience base that, you know, that you could kind of risk doing that and not alienate, you know, because let's be honest, if not for Lynch's movie, this one, people would, except for me and, like, Keith and the people who read the books, they wouldn't have really cared, other than the fact that the director, Denny, was the one that was doing it, which is kind of like Nolan, where he's so big that anything he does, you know, he could do, if he did, like, a Care Bear movie, people would just for the fact that he's the one being the director, people would watch a Care Bear movie.
Exactly.
It's going to be, like, really great.
And that's why I kind of understand some of the changes he made, because this is kind of on his back in a way. But like I said, it's interesting that they did a gamble like that. I haven't really seen it done that way. Because then I remember in the past where movies that we know did bad and the studios know they did bad, they did so bad that they were talking up part two just to make people have interest in seeing part one. So that's a tactic. So I never heard of it being the other way, because I heard of them lying about part two and part three when they know good and well it wasn't going to happen because the movie bombed so badly. You know, but that's Warner Brothers and all the other kind of stuff. But I will say, I think a lot of the steam for the second one came from the fact that the first one was on Netflix and people got a chance to watch it and take their time with it. People who didn't, it's like, I seen the first one, I'm scared off of it, or didn't care for the first one, like, and they saw it on Netflix, they got a chance to sit with it. Then they saw it on HBO Max, they got a chance to sit with it. And then the fact that everything was pushed back because of the pandemic and the strike and all that kind of stuff, I think that just gave people time. And that's the same thing that happened with the Spider-Verse movies, where, you know, when it first came out, people wasn't really feeling it. But when they got a chance to see it on Netflix and sit with it and saw, man, this is a great movie. By the time the second one came out, everybody was on it. And so it benefited. And so this is one of those kind of times where the machine kind of getting stuck or jammed kind of benefited the viewer, the potential people who would like this thing, you know, got a chance to sit and have time. Because a lot of times we move so fast, and sometimes you do need that space to really take in something or give it a second watch to see how you really feel about it. And so to have that breathing room, it really gives you time and a second chance to really connect to something. Because some stuff, you cannot get it in one viewing. Even if you love it, it's hard to take in, especially when it's this dense and there's so much stuff going on. It's a relationship and you really got to take your time with it. So this, the pandemic and the time and having it on, you know, streaming really gave people time to sit with it and really kind of connect. And like I said, I think that really contributed to this, the new one coming out and giving people time to, you know, pretty much, you know, get their palate for the taste ready for what was about to come.
Yeah, definitely. Streaming has done something with movies like Dune, where unlike in the past where from movie to eventually rental and, you know, eventually like some kind of like HBO or, it would take forever. So, but now with the way that with streaming, where within like a few months, you could literally prepay for the second Dune already now.
Right.
And then by probably within a month or two, you could already, it'll already be available for digital. Right. I mean, it definitely makes it where, because I, once it went out to streaming, I watched it like a few times, the first one,
me
the
too.
First Dune. It's like, I could really like, sit back and like really dissect it because I already know what happened, so I could literally see the details. And that's the same thing with the Spider-Verse, with the Spider-Verse, especially the second Spider-Verse movie, where the more I watched it like recently, like I'm liking it more and more the second and third, fourth time around when I watch it. And I really understand that the second one, and hopefully maybe that's a another conversation we can have on the Spider-Verse movies.
For sure.
Like the second one, in my opinion, is really a masterpiece compared to the first. It's really good. Like I didn't realize that when I first watched it, I liked it, but it's only because of what streaming did, and it allows me to keep watching it later on multiple times, that I really understood. They really did a good job in that Spider-Verse, the second Spider-Verse movie. People don't, and it's a shame that they lost out in the Oscars to that The Boy and the Heron, which is a decent film, but I think that Spider-Verse actually got robbed. They should have gotten the award for the Oscar. Anyways, that's off topic, but yeah.
So it's funny, listening back to our previous conversation on the first one, for those who haven't heard it, check out our first conversation on the first part of the Dune, which was, I think it was a great discussion from different perspectives, and we covered so much. But the main thing I got out of that conversation was the term you coined, Doonies. Since you coined that, I'm going to let you start first. What was your overall thoughts on this new Dune Part 2? What was your overall thoughts of the new movie?
Did I coin that or did Keith coin that?
You did.
Oh, I did.
You said Doonie.
Was it? Did I say? Yeah, okay. I thought you coined it was Dune Night.
That was all you, bro. That was all you.
No,
not Goonies, but Doonies.
Because you were like, is it Dune Night or Doonie? You were trying to figure it out, but you end up having different terms, but we end up with Doonie.
Wow.
Yeah, so as an official coiner of the word Doonies. So what was your thoughts on the new movie?
Okay, so I definitely like the second one more than I like the first one. When I went to watch the second one, versus what I did in the first one, is I really tried to separate. I said, okay, I'm not gonna like think about Lynch's movie at all. Like, I'm gonna say it's apples and oranges. You know, I'm not gonna try to in any way compare it to Lynch's version. And as much as possible, I'm going to see if this second one, when I went into it, I was thinking that it had to go by the by Herbert's book, like, you know, word for word. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to at least see if this movie at least got, like, the some of the important themes that Herbert was trying to say in his series. Yeah. And for the most part, it nailed, like, a lot of what I thought the themes that Herbert was trying to say in his book. So I really liked the second one. And a lot of when the trailers were coming out, mm-hmm. and when the first reviewers were, like, talking about it, they were, like, making the comparisons that it was kind of like Empire Strikes Back, in the same way that Empire Strikes Back was the better movie versus Star Wars. That's kind of the way I also viewed it too, where this, the second one definitely is the better movie. And it's not just the better movie, it's, like, monumentally a lot better than the first movie, almost to the point where I almost felt like the first movie, you almost thought that it was not the same director. But it was, but that's how good the second movie was. I felt like the second movie was more open, and it wasn't, like, the first movie, I felt like Denny was, like, somehow hampered. I don't know why, because of whatever limitations. He didn't want to give too much in the first movie, but he wanted to give a story, but he didn't want to give too much away. So it kind of took away from the first movie. But the second movie, it's almost like, okay, now it's wide open. I can say whatever I want to say, and you see that on the film in the second one. So yeah, I definitely like the second Dune a lot more than the first one. And, you know, I guess I could say I'm an official Dooney now from the second movie.
Yeah, kind of. I remember you didn't necessarily care for the first one. Like, you didn't hate it or nothing, but you didn't really care for it.
Yeah,
so that's good to
yeah, I didn't. I said that it's worth watching. The first one is good, where it's worth watching. But if you were a fan of Herbert or even Lynch, then there's going to be problematic things about it. But it's still, I wouldn't tell people not to watch it. It's a good movie. The first one is on its own, it's a good movie.
So, Captain Keith, what says you?
I liked it more than the first one.
Okay.
But it had more action. It was easier to watch. Certain characters stood out more. They were more likable. But it was still problematic for me.
Okay.
It wasn't necessarily the same problems that I had with the first one. So there were different problems, like the liberties they took with the book, or the deviations from the book that they overtly and blatantly did, I didn't care for at all. As I said before, Denis Villeneuve's cinematography is great. I mean, it's visually stunning. It is. The way he made it look looks great. That was never a complaint of mine. And even the direction, I don't have a problem with his direction. There were just things I just didn't care for.
Okay.
I liked it more than the first one, but I still, I would still refer people back to Lynch's first film. I mean, Lynch's version. And I would actually, the sci-fi miniseries sticks closer to the book. It just doesn't look as good. Mm-hmm. So and it was always the irony that if you could have combined the miniseries with Lynch's movie, it would have been, like, perfect. Because Lynch gave you the look and the feel and the style and the story. He gave it, his movie grabs you. I mean, and it's even to this day, when I read those books, or whenever I, you know, or when I'm seeing a new, you know, version of Dune, I still go back to his film. You know, Kyle MacLachlan is still my Paul Atreides. That's just not going to change. You know, and Sting is still my fade. So, but yeah, there were certain characters that you saw more of, but they just, I didn't like how you portrayed them at all. So yeah, it was still problematic for me. So yeah, I'm not recommending it. I'm not. I think it's better than the first, but yeah, it's still problematic. I still go back to Lynch, period.
That's fair. All right, so I liked the movie. I won't say necessarily I liked it better than the first one. I kind of liked slow burn movies, so I don't mind, because a lot of world building and get to know the characters and stuff, and seeing how people's actions kind of dictate places and positioning and things like that, like almost like watching a chess match. So I like that about the first one. I liken this one to being on a roller coaster ride where you go through, you know, you kind of go through the motions. There's no real action, anything really happening. You just kind of slowly inclining, just going slowly up and up and up and up. And you're moving in a way where by the time you get to the top, you don't realize you were that high up because of the way you got there. And so when you hit the peak and then you, you know, descend, and it's just fast and furious and just, you know, you're hitting these corners real fast. That's what this movie was. So if the first one was to build up, this one was kind of like, you know, hang on tight. This is when everything's kind of happening. To me, it's less detailing and less kind of insight in a way. It's insight, but it's in a different kind of way. The first one did most of the heavy lifting. And then for those like in movies that we see nowadays, like in theaters and stuff, this is the meat that people usually start with in movies. This is what the kind of movies people would go into in the first place. They wouldn't want to hear the talking and the negotiating and the slow world building. They want the fast pace. They want the action. They want the cool gadgets. They want the, you know, the kick-ass leader who's, you know, pushing forward and this, that, and the, you know, the betrayal and the big bad guy. You know, you want that meet up with your enemy. You want the eye-to-eye combat and how this is going to be dealt with kind of thing. And so it has all that kind of stuff in it. For me, it was almost so fast-paced that I almost didn't really appreciate it for what it was until I saw it a second time. And then I saw, okay, they did have other stuff in here, and there was some nuances going on here, but it was just, the pace was just so much faster than the first one. And so when you said that, it almost felt like it was a different director. I hear you as far as, like, it was definitely a different speed, but it also had a different job. And then it's also something about like not knowing what the future of something's going to be and how much to give, how much not to give, because if you give too much, it could be confusion. If you don't give enough, it's going to stalemate it, because it's like you give me half the information. So it is a fine line, and the whole story in the first place is a hard it's a hard thing to navigate to make into a movie, because really a streamlined version of this would be the Star Wars, and that's already been done. So for you trying to do something here, more meat, and still streamline it again, but not streamline it the way somebody who copies you streamlined it, you gotta find that third rail. And it's like, how do I stay true, but give you what I know is gonna work, but then not give you what somebody else did where it worked really good. And so navigating that is almost gotta be a whole new car to fit on this new track, and kind of doing that fine line of, like I said, was popular and done by someone else already in a great way, and something that was done where, you know, people maybe not messing with it because it's just a little too much. And unless you just really into that kind of world and open to that kind of stuff, you ain't trying to hear it. It's like, it's just too much. And so I think this movie did it well. I thought that that it left on a good beat, making me want another one. And I take it as not necessarily a comparison to the first one, but just the same ride, different part of the ride. But I did enjoy it, and I'm looking forward to the next one. Saying that, I guess we could get to the spoilers or things that stood out that you liked or stood out that just kind of wasn't sitting with you. We could discuss that part here. But for the most part, Joselito still recommended it. I would recommend it, and Captain Keith would pass on it. No. He wouldn't necessarily recommend it.
Nope.
Okay, and that's fair. Okay. All right, so let's get into spoiler discussions. Who would like to start with their thoughts? Like I said, something that stood out, or even just going down the line of what the movie did, because it pretty much started off where the last one left off, which I thought was kind of interesting. So it was a direct continuation, no time jump or anything. It was just like, this is the situation. He met the, you know, the Fremen. He's on the road with them. They're suspicious of him. Some of them are. Some of them could possibly see a Messiah amongst them as prophesied. So it's a lot of stuff going. A lot of stuff going.
I was excited initially for the second movie because I'm a big Florence Pugh fan. And also, I love Christopher Walken. But oddly enough, the way that the movie... That this is one of the like negative things about the movie, or things that I didn't necessarily like about the second Dune, was I didn't necessarily like the way that Pugh's character and especially Christopher Walken's character were done. Christopher, like, there was something about Christopher Walken's character that as an emperor that was so weak. Like, there wasn't, and again, I don't want to keep going back to Lynch's version, but this is a character that's supposed to have plotted the downfall of the Atreides family, and the way Christopher Walken portrays him is he seems so indecisive and very weak. That's, it makes sense to me. And the Florence Pugh character, like, while she gave exposition to the other side of the story that we didn't get the first one, there wasn't anything compelling enough about the way she portrayed her character, where at the very end, when Chani is pissed off that Paul basically is going to marry the emperor's daughter,
Princess Arulin's character,
there wasn't anything about the way Florence Pugh's character acted, where from Chani's perspective, that she shouldn't have been so like the jealousy thing, like that's part of the thing. And I don't want to keep going back to the Lynch movies, but in the Lynch movie, I think it's what's that actress that plays the emperor's daughter,
Virginia Madsen.
Oh my god, she's like so gorgeous.
Yes.
So, and even in Herbert's book, the emperor's daughter is, you know, beyond just being the emperor's daughter, like she is attractive, and you know, they're like, she would be someone where someone like Chani would be rightfully jealous. Like, you know, are you gonna just hook up with her? Aside from her title, it's also because she's attractive, and does that mean I'm gonna lose you? Nothing about the Pugh's character says anything to me where Chani would ever feel threatened that she would take Paul away from her, because both the emperor's daughter and the emperor come off as very weak in the second Dune. That's one of the weaker parts of that movie for me.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned that. I think Florence Pugh was amazing. And I didn't care for her performance either. I didn't care for her look. I didn't like her with the short hair. I felt like all the women in the film were overly unglamorized. I think they did too much with that. I did not care for Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica at all. This is the one performance that she's done I did not care for. I did not like her interpretation of it at all. Nothing about her said Lady Jessica. Nothing about her said sensual, strong, beautiful woman who fell in love with Leto Atreides. There was no chemistry. It's just nothing. If anything, she became more of a Harkonnen. You know, and we know the irony in that, but I did not care for her at all in that. And Princess Irulan, Florence Pugh, nothing about her said beautiful princess who is a Bene Gesserit trained woman who's going to marry Paul.
I think how they messed up on Princess Irulan is Florence Pugh is attractive as an actress.
She wasn't.
Why
in that
is she
film?
Wearing this weird like chainmail? Like she's, you know, like.
Why is her hair cut so short?
I don't understand.
Princess Irulan like that.
What they should have done is they should have. That's the contrast where Chani is literally like a Fremen who are like, they don't put makeup. There's no fancy dresses that the women wear. It's very like, it's very somber and it's very practical. They could have made Pugh where she's dressed so elegantly, where that would be a threat to Chani, because she would think that she epitomizes more of like a feminine thing that Paul as a man would be like and be attracted to. But I don't know if that's the right word, dumb down. How would you make, it's like
they
dumbing
down her looks,
but in terms of the looks,
all the women, they dulled the women's looks down. Zendaya still looks good, but her looks were dumbed down too, or dulled down too. It just because they're on this desert. When you watch, see, I have no problem going back to the Lynch movie, because without the Lynch movie, I wouldn't even be here talking about Dune at all. Period. That movie changed my life. I read all those books after watching that one film, you know, as a teenager. I never did that before. So, and he's one of my favorite directors anyway, but putting that to the side, getting back to the story, I mean, where do I start? I mean, so Dave Bautista plays the Beast Raban, temperamental, bully, coward. Nothing about him said ferocity. Nothing about him said a menace. His portrayal was horrible. So when you talk about Christopher Walken as the Emperor, and I love Christopher Walken. You wasted his performance. I blame Denis Villeneuve for that, his direction on him, because he was useless. He was weak. There was nothing. There was nothing there. Nothing there. And like I said, getting back to Florence Pugh, especially after seeing her, Black Widow, just seeing her in the Marvel stuff, seeing how amazing of an actress she is, she's definitely dulled down. You know, like I said, people forget she's a Bene Gesserit as well. She was trained by the Bene Gesserit. She's beautiful and she's trained for a purpose. You know, I mean, to be princess, to be co-ruler of the universe. You don't get any of that from that. You don't. And then when I think about the Harkonnens, and I still can't stand how they call them Harkonnens. Oh, that gets on my nerves. They look like Borg. What the hell was that? They look like Borg.
What did it look like in the book? How are they described in the
book? They look like regular people with just red hair. Just red-haired evil people. That's, you know, that's it.
Red-haired evil people. Okay, that's kind of general.
Yeah, but I mean, they're Irish. I mean, they have red hair. But I mean, they look like a noble house. They don't look like these evil aliens trying to assimilate the whole universe. I mean, they don't look like that. Now, Austin Butler, his performance was good. But I didn't care for the look at all. I didn't care for the look of Giddy Prime. It was too over the top. It's like, this is a great house. There's a reason why they were on Arrakis. There's a reason why the Emperor liked them. Yes, they're evil. Yes, and yes, they're corrupt, but way too over the top with that. There's nothing about Giddy Prime, nothing. And then even Skarsgård, I forget his name, Stellan, the dad, yes. Played the Baron. Mm-hmm. Great actor, wasted as the Baron. Not enough time, not enough seeing him fleshed out. And then there's this iconic moment where Paul reveals something that his mother already knew about who the Baron is to them. And for me, it was wasted when you got to that moment. He revealed the moment, but how they got rid of the Baron, not in the book, not in any of the movies. Now, a friend of mine I was talking to last night, he's new to Dune. He watched the first movie that Denis Villeneuve did, and then recently he watched David Lynch's version, and then he went and saw part two. And so he loves Lynch's version, and he's appreciating all of it. Now, he said to me, that I have to give it to him, because I told him, I complained about how I felt like the iconic moment where Paul says to his mother, you know, you are the Baron's daughter, we're Harkonnens. And she's like, well, yeah, once I took the water of life, I already knew that. But when Denise showed you that scene and he showed the Baron looking at the daughter, that was something new. That was cool. But when he goes and he kills the Baron and says, grandfather, okay, you did that. That's not how it went in the book. You did that. But for me, that wasn't, there should have been more to that moment. Now, my friend said for him it was, because he hadn't read the books. So for him, that was the same aha moment that you got in, you know, in Empire Strikes Back, Luke, I'm your father. I'll never forget that scene with, you know, with Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. And that's the one complaint I had with Lynch's film. So then he gave that to me, but I didn't like the feeling. It felt flat on me when I was watching it. It felt flat. But like I said, my friend, for him, it didn't. So maybe that's just me on that. But there were just so many different things. I liked Javier Bardem as Stilgar. He was fun. He was likable. I liked that. I didn't like the fact that Jameis came back to Paul, you know, as someone helping his, you know, a spiritual advisor. You killed the black man in the first one, but it's okay now because we're going to put his water in here with the sacred people, and now he's going to guide you. Nah, man, get the fuck out of here with that. You know, that goes back to why I hated the first one. Zendaya, I liked her as Chani. It's a surprise. And I liked her more in this as Chani. I could feel her conflict. And like you said too, Jay, about how there were some Fremen there looking at him sideways. And that was cool. But and it just seems like she's in love with him, but she don't trust him. She don't know how to feel. So and that's a different way of playing it, because it's not really like that like in the book. So that was interesting, but yeah, I just, and then even with the sandworms, you know how you're at the airport and you're walking to your gate and you got that moving escalator thing, the moving floor. That's what I felt I was looking at when they were riding the sandworms. Nothing about that to me was great. Getting to the part, the conversation still got had with him, don't make me look bad. All that leading up to him getting on the sandworm, that was cool and fun. And the Fremen teasing him, all that, and their language, that was cool. But with them riding the sandworms, I was just like, really? I don't even see it's like you're just moonwalking across the desert right now.
Sorry, I wanted to bring this up because you brought up Jameis Keith to Jason. Because Jason, I don't know, you haven't read the books. Or did you watch the Lynch movie version?
Yeah, and I've seen it again recently. I seen it when it first came out, didn't necessarily care for it, but I seen it again recently. Okay. And being that I saw the new movies, it made that movie make more sense to me.
Yeah, because in the Jameis character, also in the book, the Denise version doesn't talk about at all, is that Jameis has a wife and two kids, two boys. And when Paul kills him, he basically becomes the head of that household. And that's something that they don't bring up at all with the Denny. So Keith, when you bring up, like, it didn't make sense that, Jameis was kind of like a spiritual advisor to him. The fact that Denny didn't have, a wife and the kids that basically now fall under Paul's, authority, that actually didn't make sense that he was coming back to advise them. Because isn't it the first movie, were they ever like buddy? They were never like,
no,
like
they were never friends. No.
So it doesn't make sense that he's coming back to him like the Jedi spirit or something. It didn't make sense that in the second movie, like, what now if you have something where Paul, like in the book, now becomes the guardian of the wife and the two kids, that would kind of make sense where Jameis would, for the sake of his family, would be kind of advising Paul, because it's in his best interest to make sure that, Paul is able to survive, because he's going to be the one taking care of his family. I'm just adding that for context, because I wasn't sure if you knew about that detail. That's a very important detail, actually. So.
Put it like this, it wasn't anything to make me think about it, so it wasn't like I felt it was missing, which I would prefer than to have something there and I'm kind of like, what does that mean? So it didn't come up about his family or anything like that. As far as like Christopher Walken's, my only issue with him is that he's just very well known, almost too well known for me to have him in there. The princess, she was fine. It's interesting, like, in the original movie, she kind of starts off the movie with her, doing dictation of what was going on. So it's interesting that they put that in this one and started this one almost in the same way as the original movie did with her kind of doing an accounting of what's going on. Christopher Walken's, the Emperor, I didn't really trip off of it because it kind of made sense when the thing came up about him kind of being, I don't know if I would say jealous, but he didn't care for Paul's father and how he was doing things. And so it always kind of make me kind of think, when I think of a ruler or somebody like that, it's not necessarily the strongest person. It's the person who got away with the most dirt and got a chance to be on top. So they're never really looking for challenges. You know what I mean? And so I almost tie this into like real life and politicians and stuff like that, where the big guy who you think would be the, that would lead the charge is usually not the leader. It's somebody else who's dictating what's going on. And then also with the Bene Gesserits, and you kind of know, like, they kind of playing chess with these pieces that, yeah, the truth is they're running the whole thing. So regardless of who's there, what faces they are, they're playing on both sides. They're playing the black and the white. They're playing both sides. They're making up the whole mythology. They're making the whole thing up and then doing things to make sure everything falls into that path. So, guys being manipulated by the women, that's kind of the theme of this that I'm getting, at least that I'm seeing in the movie so far. So I don't take it as, now in Lynch's film, I never saw or felt that from seeing it. I never saw that they were like people that was kind of like not down with what he was doing. It's almost like he had this, maybe for his privileged life, kind of hard, his rise and becoming this messiah, But I didn't feel that in the original movie. It seemed like he just was kind of like doing his thing. This one, it kind of shows all the trappings and what's kind of helping him flow forward and what's trying to stop him. So it's all these little nuances of how Messiah is built. Even questioning, could he even be a Messiah? And the fact that people reading the room are like, this doesn't feel right, or this isn't right. I love seeing that, because it's kind of like, because I know you said that the thing about the white savior thing, because they show like the brown people at the Fremen and stuff like that. But even the original movie is that too. That this is a character who is a white savior coming to be the leader of indigenous people. So in the movie,
but it's not overt.
But still, it's the same. It's
more overt.
Overt or not, but like this, that whole theme that I think is very important. It was lost on me seeing the original film because everybody looked the same. So I never thought of it like, oh, he's coming to America and he's, you know, killing off the Indians, and he's supposed to be Messiah for the Indians. So I didn't notice that in the first movie. But seeing this, it's like, yeah, who is this white dude coming through here? Or not even white. This alien coming down and saying that he is going to be like, we are not going to save ourselves. This guy is going to come in, be it green, purple, whatever. Some alien from a different place is going. Superman is going to be our savior, not us. We're Lex Luthor being like, this is the problem. Some people are happy, but I don't like it. I don't want to have my destiny with this situation. So seeing it broken up with different races, different color people, I didn't notice it in the first one, but seeing with this is like, okay, yeah, that would be a problem. And I'm glad people are saying stuff about it. And it's just funny how, like I said, it was interesting because the whole time he's reluctant. Paul's reluctant. And his mom is pushing forward. And the Bene Gesserits, they're pushing forward. And everybody's kind of moving. But just to see how... It seemed like more like destiny in the original movie. This one seemed like it was plotted. And even though it takes some of the mystery out for it being so plotted, it also kind of just, if you like politics and you like chess, this movie kind of plays more like a chess game, and you're just seeing like, man. And also the fact of how things come into power. And if you're on one side, if you hear certain kind of things, then yes, you grew up religious, you're going to feel like, you know, Jesus is going to come down and save you. And so the people who believe what was told is going to be more acceptable to these certain pushes or certain things kind of happening. You could be played on your feelings about this thing. And if you don't, yeah, you'd be kind of skeptical, like an atheist, and like, well, I don't put my hope on somebody coming. Like Zendaya's character, she was kind of like, we're not waiting. You know, they give us this religion. They give us this Messiah, Chani, like, you know, we're waiting for this guy to come down, and we got to save ourselves. We got to save ourselves. And so seeing that, how it's broken down, and like I said, the witches are running everything. They're choosing who's born, who's what they have, and how it's all tied up. So really, like I said, I didn't need to necessarily see the emperor being a certain kind of way, because he wasn't running stuff anyway. This is almost kind of like, this is the perspective of the truth of what's going on versus like, yes, the other side of it, where it would just be this smooth thing like, yeah, these pieces are locking in because it was destined. We see the side where people see where it's destined and how it just falls into place. And we also see the side where they're laying track. We're going here, and we're going to tell these people this place, and we're going to go this side. And we give them all these different kind of possibilities so we can make sure our piece makes it across the line. And to do dual of storytelling, to give both sides, and you watch it at the same time, is brilliant. And I didn't get that from the first one. I thought it was kind of interesting to see that being played.
But what you're missing though, Jay, and why you do need to see more of the Emperor, is because the reason why the Emperor does this to the Atreides family is because he's jealous of Leto Atreides.
That was said. I knew that. That was said.
Okay. Well,
he didn't like how that he felt that he was moving and ruling by a heart, and he needed to be, I guess, a tougher breed of leader to make sure it happens.
Well, and but he was also afraid of being replaced by Leto Atreides, because everyone loved Duke Leto, because he was Leto the Just, and because Duke Leto has a son, and the Emperor has nothing but daughters, because the Bene Gesserit made sure of that. Because what they don't tell you, and it's in the prequel books in House Corno, Dune House Corno, basically, Shaddam IV was so ruthless, he basically kill one of his brothers so he'd become emperor. He wanted to be emperor at all costs. And because of that, he was so smart, he was stupid. When he became emperor, he was supposed to choose someone from one of the Lancerot, one of the noble houses to marry to solidify, the throne. The Bene Gesserit came to him and said, "Well, why don't you choose her? She's a Bene Gesserit, and this way you don't have to pick one of the houses. You could be neutral with that and just have her as your concubine or your wife." So he's like, "Okay, I'll do that." And they told her, "Have nothing but daughters for him." So that's also at play with this backstory. Now, what they don't also tell you is that, you're right, the Bene Gesserit, they're pulling all the strings, they're manipulating the houses, for the Qazi Haderach. But when you see Lynch's version, you understand that love is what changed this whole story. The great love between Lady Jessica and Duke Leto is what changed this whole story when she decided to give him a son instead of a daughter. But you don't get that in Denis's new version. You don't get that with Rebecca Ferguson. There's nothing about her that says, "This is a great woman that I love and I should have married her."
Okay. I hated
her portrayal.
But that was said, and that's how I knew that I gave, because the mother got on her about having a son in the first place, and she said, "You gave that man a son." So the stuff you're saying,
I'm talking about the feeling. Yeah, she said all that, but like I said, Rebecca Ferguson was not convincing.
No. That's fine for you. I'm telling you how I felt about it. I'm telling you what I got from it. And so you're repeating what I'm just said, but without me even knowing the stuff that you knew. So I'm not knowing that by magic. I'm telling you what I got from watching it. So I don't know the part where I was missing that I didn't understand that, like I said, the kids were being lined up and that they had other messiahs that could possibly take the place. And if he was going to be a boy, well, the Harkonnens have a person who could be a possible messiah. Can we use him possibly? Can we control him? Let's test and find out. Let's even give him a kid. So I'm watching the movie and I'm seeing this. So I hear what you're saying, but I'm saying these things are still happening within this movie that I'm seeing that, like I said, gave me a different respect for the Bene Gesserits, because they would have seemed very kind of unassuming. And I didn't understand the levels of them until the second movie kind of dug in really how much was really going in, because and I think that's kind of powerful, because most things that are unassuming is the things that you need to look out for. So it kind of played like that for me, like I said, from the first movie to the second movie, and then to see that the Emperor's daughter was one of them too. So they kind of have their hands in all these houses and everybody's playing against the house, but they are the house and they have, like I said, they got either they're controlling people, they're swaying people, they're kind of bonding through sex and stuff with people, having their kids and making them have the kids they didn't want to so they could stack their decks. And it's just like
but it blew up in there.
It's funny how in society how things changed, where now if people kind of question women and not being strong, right, and they thinking that they gotta be strong like men, the same way we do, like beat stuff over the head or strong arm stuff, or have ego and move forward without hearing directions, the Bene Gesserit is a perfect instruction for women how feminine energy could be used to control everything without breaking a sweat, without lifting a rock, without hitting somebody over the head, and they could still rule the world. It's very interesting. It's very interesting how they are feminine. Femininity rules everything. And so it's funny, and this would be an old school thing to show this, but nowadays it's so backwards thinking that a woman got to outman a man when the true power is getting the man to do what they want to in all these different kind of ways, because all the ways that it can be used in real life, they're doing it in these movies. And it's very interesting to see. And it's a good lesson, do what you want, but I'm just saying, the way the women are moving in here is like classic feminine power.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that the Lynch movie, and it's in the book too. That's the whole thing that the Denny's version doesn't really talk about, that Lynch talks about, where in Lynch's version, when Paul does the box test,
the Gum Jabbar.
Gum Jabbar, before he does it, the Bene Gesserit, is it
Reverend Mother Helen Gaius Mohiam?
Gaius Mohiam tells him that there's an aspect of like like they can't, like the Bene Gesserit can't look at a certain spectrum. Like they can only see the feminine side, but when it comes to the masculine side, that's the one thing that they can't, and they're afraid of going. And that's the duality that Herbert's book talks about, the feminine versus the masculine, that I kind of wish that Benny had, he didn't really go over that.
No. But
Jason, it's interesting you bring up the whole thing, feminine power. That's one of the aspects that, you know, are not really talked about. That's something in society where they say one of the ways that you could, like, be it like a tyranny towards like women is like you control the reproductive rights. That's one of the, that's a superpower. Yes, women still would need a man to become pregnant, but the fact that a woman can literally bear a life inside of her, that's like a very powerful thing.
Yes,
that, you know, the book kind of talks about, and the why there is that power in the feminine side, and that the Bene Gesserit behind the scenes, the control that they're doing, they control genetic bloodlines. That's basically what they're doing. And that just shows that, like what you're saying, they don't have to have the masculine traits of being overtly violent, you know, hitting you over the head. They just go behind the scenes. They do a lot of like ninja stuff.
Right.
But there's stuff that they've been able to like manipulate all these things behind the scenes. They basically control the entire religion of the Fremen for like hundreds of years because of the you know, prophecies that they put on that planet.
Right.
And so that's one of the interesting things. And one of the things I want to go back real quick is that when they revealed that Jessica is the daughter of Baron, I didn't like the way that I understand for the sake of time that having that 5-second scene where Baron sees his daughter, who's, mm-hmm. you know, Jessica. In the original prequel books, the Baron never knows that she's the daughter. I'll go back to Keith's point about the Harkonnen. I definitely like the way Fate, they showed Fate in terms of like, you know, this just psychotic character, but there's something about him, despite his psychoticness, where I could see there's an appeal to him, even though he's like a crazy person. But one of the things that I didn't like about the way the Harkonnens were portrayed, where they do the whole board thing where it's like black and white, yeah. and everybody looks like they're just like they didn't look human anymore. And even the planet itself, everything is monotone. Yeah. Even the fireworks when they're celebrating.
Basically, wasn't it the sun or something, or eclipse or something going on that they did that for, right? And so that's why the light was weird, right?
I thought, well, the fact that they were like, it's almost devoid of color. It was trying to say that somehow they're not like regular humans. Like they're humans, but that they lack like some kind of like, it was a deliberate thing where to say, okay, this is the bad guys. We already know that they're bad guys,
yeah, but
they
also over the top.
They went over the top, and yeah. and I wish they didn't do that.
But for him to kind of be there, kind of introducing what he's going to mean to the people, I didn't mind that scene. I thought it was kind of powerful, and then also the fact that they, you know, the people he was fighting was drugged, and he was like, "Hey, I'm not going to be drugged." So it kind of, to me, gave him a little more credit as far as like. He's not just going for the glory. He's just not posturing. He wants that kind of heat, unlike the Beast. Like, he saw danger coming and he ran the other way. Like, he's ready to fight when he could win, you know? So we kind of saw what the Beast was about versus him, where he wants a fair match. He's not scared. He respects a fair battle. He doesn't mind. He's giving people credit after he kills them. Like, you gave me a good fight. Like, good fight, Fremen. Like he gives credit where credit's due. It's no, like, I don't ego about it, but I'm the best and I'm nuts and I'm going to go for mine. And so... Well,
and the one, I'll say the interesting thing about the Fate character in this movie, and I think it solidifies what I think about why the Bene Gesserit wanted a pairing of the Harkonnen and Atreides, where I was saying that the Harkonnen represents... like intelligent strategy and ruthlessness to get the job done, and the Atreides are the charismatic side. And you could even see that in the fight with Fate and Atreides, where Fade looked like he was going to win that fight.
Yeah.
Right? And even during the movie, that you could see that there's nothing about Paul in this movie other than the fact that he does, you know, he goes on some of the raids and he helps save Chani. But he doesn't show anything in terms of where he's like a strategist and a leader. Immediately when Fade gets the leadership of Arrakis, he immediately like is able to like allow them to start mining the spice again without worrying about the and like I said, when he almost beats Paul, he's clearly like a better fighter than Paul, and Paul is just, you know, he wins because of, you know, the what I call the trope of the good guy succeeding, where like they somehow come off, and you know, Fade should have won that fight. And I know for the sake of the story, of course, he's not going to win the fight, but the way that they made that up to that point, I felt disappointed. I didn't want Paul to get killed, but they did it in such a way where Paul didn't really win. Like it solidified the point to me that I started saying, okay, then Jessica screwed up, because if the Bene Gesserit had their way, the leader for the Kwisatz Haderach would have been a better one than the way Paul is, in terms of, because Paul doesn't have, is lacking that part of the, he's Harkonnen, but he's mostly Atreides in his traits and the way he acts, and the whole thing with the Emperor saying that he didn't like Duke Leto, right, because he led with his heart and he didn't lead with like a ruthlessness that you needed in order to be a good leader. And that's also, I think, what Paul, and I am curious if they do this in the third movie, where it'll show that why he's, as much as they say he's the Kwisatz Haderach, there's things that he lacks that means that makes him, he's not the ideal, he's actually not the Kwisatz Haderach. And if it goes off the books, Paul Atreides is not the true Kwisatz Haderach.
I wouldn't think anybody would be necessarily anyway, because they made the whole thing up. Like I said, they made the race and they put the pieces and laid the track for their own person to kind of win.
The whole thing, and I think, did they talk about this in the first movie, where the Bene Gesserit is telling Jessica that she was supposed to have a daughter?
Yes.
And the daughter was going to marry eventually Fade. Be with the Fade.
They didn't say that part, but they said she's supposed to have a daughter, but then you come to find out on this movie that they were supposed to be paired together, because Fade was going to be the other side of it.
Then that child would be the
Kwisatz Haderach. Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
So my take, and the reason why I didn't like the way that the Harkonnens were done in this, is yes, they're bad guys. We get that. We already got that in the first movie. But the point of the matter is the reason why they're Kwisatz Haderach, what the Bene Gesserit wanted, is the Harkonnen. And Atreides is the Harkonnen has all the traits of ruthlessness and leadership, right?
And intelligence.
But
the Baron's intelligent, man.
Yes.
Just cruel. And,
but the Atreides have the charisma, right? So when you pair those two together, the Kwisatz Haderach will not only have the ruthlessness, and also they can control him for the Fremen, but he'll also have the charisma that will actually make the followers, because Fremen don't like Harkonnen. If you have someone that has the ruthlessness of the Harkonnens, but the charisma of the Atreides, then that's your ultimate weapon. And that's what I was getting when I read the books, and also Lynch's version kind of hinted at that. And I wish that that's the one part that I wish that, you know, I wanted, and they kind of made the Harkonnens like a little bit likable, in the sense that there's that scene when Fade is gonna get the governorship of Arrakis, right? And he's standing before the Baron.
Which doesn't happen in the book at all.
It doesn't have to, it's an interpretation.
But what he does is, there's a moment when he actually hisses, there's a sign of affection that the Fade does to the Baron, that in just that one moment, I didn't like love the Harkonnens because of that, but I started seeing them as, oh, they're not just, you know, just the bad guys. They're throwaway bad guys where there's nothing, there's no depth beyond them being evil. But that sign of affection, Because you rarely see that in movies where it's a clear-cut bad guy, like irredeemable bad guy, where they would show like a sign of affection that makes them deeper than the trope of, oh, I'm just an evil bad guy. There's nothing likable. But just him doing that, it kind of makes them more, because I wanted the Harkonnens to be more complex, where I don't even want to say, if you want to say good or bad, it's a perspective of like, because you could argue that like the Atreides are no better than the Harkonnens, because they also are using the Fremen. And in fact, you could even argue that the Atreides are actually worse than the Harkonnens, because the Harkonnens aren't coming in not like hiding who they are. They're saying, this is who we are. This is what we're going to do. Atreides are trying to come off as, oh, we're your friends, but then we're manipulating you into thinking that, you know, if you side with us, then we're going to save you from, you know, from the evils of the Harkonnens and the rest of the universe. When in fact, they're actually doing the same thing that any other house would do, and just exploiting.
So the thing you were saying about them, you know, wanting for her to have a daughter, so, you know, so they could kind of like have the ultimate messiah, like, when you find out that the Baron is her father, you find out that Lady Jessica basically skipped the line and made that combination of the two.
Yes.
Without them controlling. And that's why the problem was.
That's the beauty of it.
They already made him. So it's like you kind of threw us off. And then you made on top of that. And that's why it's kind of working for him, unfortunately for them. But I was going to speak to the point where you kind of brought up again, which is a good point, and which I was thinking about, I watched it as well, is how the Harkonnens and the, what you call it, are like, they're the same. Yeah, they're kind of like the same. And they're on the same track. And it's funny because, and that's why the Fremen is like, you know, half of them are kind of like, we don't believe you. We don't trust it. Because, and the thing is, Paul knows the outcome. He knows he's bringing death to them, right? And he's reluctantly, you know, his humanity is stopping on being like, you know, I don't want to match up with this leadership stuff, because the more you think about it, I mean, you'll follow me and I'm gonna get you in trouble. And he don't want to tell them what kind of trouble it's going to be, but he knows. So they think he's being humble. He's knowing, because he's seeing that he's going to lead them into a dark situation. And so I thought that in this movie, it showed that well, versus the other movie. I didn't see it like that. I didn't see it as the fight for, it felt like he, even over his wanting to get revenge, he was still trying to do the right thing. And then he thought like, maybe I could do both. Maybe I could kind of be this, you know, messiah, and maybe I could kind of get revenge for my father and help them out too. But in his visions that he's seeing forward on, he's seeing the truth that's going to lead to death and everything. So it's just interesting to see him fighting. Me actually understanding and seeing the way this is being shot and told, that he's fighting, and he's fighting it for a reason. He's not that he's afraid. Well, he's afraid, but he's not afraid like I can't do it. He's afraid that what it's going to mean. And that mixed in that pile of death and destruction is the woman of his dreams and the woman of his heart, you know, is going to be in that pile. And so it's funny how, if it wasn't for her or his connection to her, he wouldn't be trying to pull on the brakes on all this stuff. He would just be leaning in like his mom is. That's why his mom's so quick to be like, okay, we got to get them believers over there. We got to get them first, because they already believe. And he's like, this stuff is not, you know, and she survived the poison because of this. Is it like, he's giving all the magic tricks out. So every time they try to be like, cause she's the one, because he's the one, he's like, no, this trick is done because she could change poisons. And I can, you know, and so even the thing where he comes back and it's partly because of her tear, it almost makes you even wonder what he would have just woke up anyway, because he got another dose of the poison, or she knew how far along he would be out and knew he'd wake up. And that's why she's pressing her to hurry up and put your tear in there, cause he's going to wake up in the next 5 minutes. It kind of deconstructs the whole ploy / story / you know, the truth of the Messiah and all that kind of stuff, the religion, the all that stuff is being played with. And like I said, it's just like, it's just making the whole thing of a Messiah very skeptical. And other stuff that you see with these kind of things, they usually don't play with that. They let you just believe that that's the Messiah, and they're going to come and they're going to save you and make everything right. And you're going to be, and if you do happen to die, it's because you would have died for the reason, you know, for a good reason. And this kind of shows you, like I said, behind the scenes. And I usually don't see things that kind of give you both sides of it and how he was reluctant, because usually it's like, oh, because he's afraid or he doesn't know who he is. No, he know who he is. He just knows what it means, and we do too. And so to see it, like him putting on the brakes and why he's putting on the brakes is refreshing to kind of show how, like I said, how a messiah, a hero, a person in charge, whatever, how that is not as magical or as, you know, happenstance as we think. It's a lot of behind the scenes measures that are happening. And also that the Messiah could be false. Like, it's hard to believe because that's what you've been groomed to believe, but it could very well be false and could lead you into a problem. And so it's almost like he's supposed to be a hero, but you're seeing that he's kind of not. But I'm just watching it to see where this is going to go. But it's not the normal path of a person who was a chosen one. It's almost like Neo almost got kind of questioned in the second movie when he came across the architect and kind of said he wasn't the only one.
Why am I here?
Your life is the sum of a remainder of an unbalanced equation inherent to the programming of the Matrix. You are the eventuality of an anomaly which, despite my sincerest efforts, I have been unable to eliminate from what is otherwise a harmony of mathematical precision. While it remains a burden assiduously avoided, it is not unexpected and thus not beyond a measure of control, which has led you inexorably here.
You haven't answered my question.
Quite right. Interesting. That was quicker than the others.
Others?
How many?
Others.
What? Answer my question.
The Matrix is older than you know. I prefer counting from the emergence of one integral anomaly to the emergence of the next, in which case this is the sixth version.
Five ones before me.
There are only two possible explanations.
There were five ones before me.
Either no one told me, or no one knows.
Precisely.
And he is part of this thing that's going to reset this thing. Now, he made a couple of different kind of moves, but you are still that key that we made. Now, you have a little wiggle room of stuff, but you still are a pawn. As much magic you could do, and you're stopping stuff, and you're flying, and you got the best connection, Wi-Fi connection, and all the other people who's plugged in, you are still a pawn. And so this is kind of the same thing. Like, he's still not the good guy. Like, he still could lead them into death and could still be the thing that Chani was warning him about. Like, he's not the one. Like, this is not how it comes. And so her seeming like to be the outlier in a way, you know, her and her friends, it's a group of them, not just her. And to see the other side, like Sogard, to see him just so willingly pushing for it. Like, he's a Morpheus that's like, hey, you're the one. You're the one. Regardless, I'm not the one. You're the one.
What was said was for you and for you alone.
So it's the same kind of thing. So it's interesting to see like the other side of the Messiah. And I thought it was like really cool.
Hey, this is Jay, and I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. I just want to let you know that this conversation is part of a larger conversation that continues on the next episode. Thanks for listening.